Ever since soldiers began shooting at their enemies, most of their shots have missed. But in the past few years, military technology has made possible a whole armory of guided weapons whose accuracy may change the nature of conventional warfare. From now on, most aim shots will hit their target. If a soldier can see a target, he will hit it. If he hits it, he will destroy it. Because so few shots hit their target in the past, soldiers had to saturate areas where targets were believed to be with masses of projectiles, a tactic widely used in the First World War with massed artillery bombardments of trenches and frontline areas. In the Second World War, the ultimate method of hitting every conceivable target within a large area was to use the atomic bomb, as at Hiroshima and here, Nagasaki. One result, of course, was much indiscriminate killing of civilians. As late as the Vietnam War in the 1960s, the Americans were dropping huge loads of bombs on jungles where guerrillas might be operating. Whole sticks of bombs had to be used in the hope of hitting a point target, such as a bridge, a truck, or a gun. Attacking such targets at low level meant heavy losses from a sophisticated anti-air defense. Trying to hit a single bridge at Tan Hoa, 30 aircraft were lost, many pilots killed. In May 1972, the Americans turned to new technology, the so-called smart bomb, codenamed Paveway. Ordinary bombs were fitted with a special nose containing a laser seeker. This time, two planes were used for the mission. A slow-flying Bronco carries this device to aim a laser beam at the target. The Bronco sets out on its mission, followed by a Phantom jet carrying a load of smart bombs, each with the laser seeker. The Bronco arrives over the bridge. The pilot switches on the laser beam to designate the target. The Phantom releases the smart bomb, which steers itself towards the laser energy reflected from the target. One bomb, one bridge. Another precision weapon tried out in Vietnam was TOW, a wire-guided missile mainly for use against tanks. Huey helicopters were used, each carrying six TOW missiles in its launching pods. The pilot aims through this optical sight, which is stabilized so he can hold the target steady in the crosshairs, even if the helicopter maneuvers steeply. Having fired the missile, he steers it through signals transmitted along the connecting wires. Helicopters armed with TOW went into action in Vietnam in May 1972, attacking a variety of targets. This is a tank. This is a truck on a supply route. another bullseye at 3,000 meters. Here, a personnel carrier is hit. And 7 seconds later, another one. Here, tow is fired at a suspicious object in a river. It blows the camouflage off a stranded tank. From another angle, a second missile destroys it. In 1 month, two helicopters scored 47 kills. 24 were tanks. The hole in the armor is small, but the effect inside is shattering. Despite these results, it took the 1973 war in the Middle East to demonstrate the full potential of precision weapons. Israel's defense along the Suez Canal was based on the Barlev line. Built between Suez and Port Said, the line consisted of a series of strong points at irregular intervals. Some miles behind the line were deployed tank units of the Israeli army. The Israeli plan was that if the Egyptians crossed the canal, they'd be pinned down by the strong points. The tanks would converge on the crossings and block the attackers long enough to allow Israel's reserves to mobilize and deliver the customary lightning knockout blow. On the afternoon of October the 6th, 1973, things went rather differently, as this partly reconstructed sequence shows. Under cover of smoke screens, Egyptian infantry paddled across the canal and scaled the sand barrier on the Israeli bank, 80 feet high. They came on in tens of thousands. Israeli strong points opened fire, and some of the Egyptians peeled off to engage them. But the mass of the infantry bypassed the strong points and advanced several miles into the Sinai Desert beyond. Many of them unpacked suitcase-like containers, which Israeli observers had noticed as they surged over the bank. They contained a Soviet-made wire-guided missile, the Sagar. The launching tube is set up on the container's lid. The guidance fins are unfolded. The warhead is fitted on, 3 kilograms of armor-piercing explosive. The Sagar has a range of over 2 kilometers. Wire connections are laid to the firing unit with its joystick for steering and its sight. When the Israeli tanks assigned to the Barlev line moved in to wipe out the Egyptians according to plan, they were picked off one by one by Sagar missiles. In 1 day, 200 tanks were wiped out. Worse was to come. On October the 8th, Israel's tank reserves, unsupported by artillery or infantry, charged forward in headlong attacks. They were met by a barrage of Sagars, ordinary rockets, and still more Sagars. Some Israeli tanks were hit by as many as 6 missiles, the wires crisscrossing like streamers. Another 200 tanks were destroyed. It was a historic turning point. For the first time ever, infantry had faced tanks alone and won. The Israeli Air Force had moved into the attack within 26 minutes of the Egyptians' first crossing on October the 6th. The bridges flung across the canal, over which reinforcements, armor, and heavy equipment would have to flow, were most vulnerable targets. But the attacking aircraft were in for another shock. An air defense network designed by the Russians in depth. Successive lines of anti-air missiles with their radars. SAM-2s for long-range targets. SAM-3s for medium range. SAM-6s making their first appearance in war. Also medium range, but mounted on tracked vehicles. They could keep up with frontline troops and give them effective protection. If Israeli planes dived to avoid the missiles, they ran into radar-directed cannon. And radar-directed ZSU machine guns, firing 4,000 rounds a minute. Israeli losses were so high that after the second day they were forced to abandon the air over the canal, unable to support their hard-pressed tanks on the ground. Egyptian aircraft scarcely crossed the canal, leaving missiles to do the job of interception. Out of 104 Israeli planes lost, 100 were hit by missiles. As a result of the 1973 war, all major powers have speeded up the production of precision-guided weapons. Miniaturization means that greater computer power can be packed even into small missiles. They're getting still more accurate, faster, and harder to counteract. Compared to tanks and aircraft, they're cheap. With mass production, they're getting cheaper. Even poor countries can afford to have some. All guided missiles have basic parts in common. A motor, perhaps a rocket or a ramjet, a high explosive warhead, a guidance package which controls its flight by actuating movable fins or rocket nozzles, and a homing head which gives the missile its accuracy. There's a wide choice of missiles according to what you want to do. To defend infantry against low-flying aircraft in daylight, Britain has the blowpipe missile. The aiming unit is fitted to a missile in a matter of seconds. One man aims and fires it. He has to get the target in his sight and keep it there. By moving the joystick, he steers it along his line of sight through radio signals. This homing head consists of a television camera which can focus on a target. This is the head of a Maverick missile, here under test in a laboratory. And this is a similar TV-guided missile, the Condor, in an operational test. On a monitor screen, the pilot focuses on the target. He locks the missile on and fires it. Then turns away to safety. It's known as launch and leave. The missile continues on its way automatically. This was the first live test against a destroyer. It was hit from a distance of 56 kilometers. In aerial dogfights between supersonic aircraft, It's difficult to hold a target in your sights long enough to use a line-of-sight system. You need a missile that can steer itself home, one with an infrared seeker. This is the French-made MAGIC missile. An infrared seeker steers itself towards any heat source of a certain intensity, from an aircraft's engine or from its exhaust. A ground-to-air missile must be able to hit in bad weather or at night, so guidance by radar is used. Britain's Bloodhound is what's known as a semi-active radar missile. This means that it works in combination with a target-illuminating radar. The target is picked up by the radar beam, which locks on and tracks it. When the missile's fired, a receiver in its nose picks up reflected radar energy and homes in. Bloodhound can score bullseyes at ranges of over 80 kilometers. Another type of radar homing is used by the Exocet missile, French-made, but in service with the Royal Navy. During the first part of its sea-skimming flight, Exocet steers by inertial navigation. As it nears the target, a radar transmitter in its nose switches on to provide the reflected energy on which it homes. It's called active radar homing. Installed on fast patrol boats, Exocet is a type of missile which puts another query against the future of big ships. Pilotless drones have been used for years as targets for gunnery practice. They can be controlled from the ground at great ranges by radio signals. In Vietnam, they were used for reconnaissance, transmitting TV pictures back to base without endangering a pilot's life. Drones are now being tested as launch platforms for weapons. Here, a drone launched from a transport aircraft is about to fire a Maverick TV-guided missile. With aircraft costing up to $10 million each, pilotless drones at $500,000 may provide an attractive alternative. They're also very hard to spot on radar because they're small and can be made of non-reflective material. The accuracy and speed of missiles will impose faster reaction times on military forces. Automation will be needed to cope with split-second decisions. Human control will be phased out. This process is already underway in the Navy, which has to cope with threats from surface and air forces and from lurking submarines as well. It's on a warship like this guided missile destroyer that automated control systems can best be seen. In action, no one's on deck. Everyone's below, protected from nuclear radiation and poison gas behind watertight, airtight doors. The missile launchers are remotely controlled. And so's the gun. There's no one in the turret. There need be no one on the bridge. No helmsman, no captain, no navigator. The ship steered and fought several decks down, below the waterline. Alongside the engine room, there's a cubicle where the helmsman steers the ship.
Port 15, steer 290.
Port 15, steer 290.
Each handle and dial, the duplicate of one on the empty bridge. The headdress gives protection against flash burn injuries. The captain commands HMS Glamorgan from the operations room. Next to him is the principal warfare officer, the PWO, a new function in the Navy. He's in overall control of all the fighting systems. Around them are a dozen other specialists sitting at identical consoles.
Opposition AWO, new contact. Track 1252, bearing 060, identified as hostile surveillance radar.
The air warfare officer, the AWO, deals with enemy aircraft and missiles. Behind him, the aircraft controller guides friendly helicopters and aircraft. This is the gun director. Behind him, the missile director and the missile controller. A warship has to know what's going on 400 kilometers around it, the distance between London and Newcastle. Tactical information can be displayed by symbols on the screen. The friendly force, for instance, each ship with its identifying number. The center square represents the ship itself. All tactical information is stored and processed by the ship's computer as it comes in from the radars and other sensors. If you want information about something, a friendly ship, say, use the tracker ball to move a strobe until it's over the desired symbol. The information appears on the adjoining screen, the tote as it's called. The ship's type, its compass bearing, speed, and so on. Radar can be shown on the screen. If a new echo appears, the computer labels it U for unidentified, and then assigns it a track number. Track 2004 turns out to be a hostile aircraft. From this console, its identification is communicated to the computers of all the other ships in the force via data link. HMS Glamorgan is about to lead a task force into an exercise. The force has a reconnaissance aircraft, a Nimrod, assigned to it, extending its vision beyond the horizon and down into the depth of the sea.
This is Nimrod Echo Charlie 7-9. Sonar contact. Classified. Possum Confidence 2.
The Nimrod spotted a submarine. Because submarines can carry missiles these days, they have to be regarded as an air threat as well.
6-5, air raid warning yellow. Air raid warning yellow. Break nice. Alpha Foxtrot, over.
A marker goes down on the surface plot.
Okay. Right, PWO Captain, let's send the helicopters to the submarine.
Roger, sir.
Echo Charlie 7-9, this is Whiskey Lima 6-5, my two seekings, southwest of you at 30 miles, coming to you for employment in pursuing submarine contact, ever.
Echo Charlie 7-9, Roger.
A Sea King lowers its sonar dipper into the depth of the sea. If there's a submarine within range, it will pick up sound echoes from it.
Captain PWO, we do have an alert to WASP in NIAID, sir. Suggest we tell NIAID to launch his WASP to join the Nimrod with these homing torpedoes.
The torpedoes have acoustic homing heads.
Six from Whiskey Lima 6-5, see you taking off from your mother. Make your heading 270.
Golf Romeo Tango Echo, this is Whiskey Lima 605. Friendly aircraft 0406, now airborne, bearing a 325. This is 65 out. unidentified aircraft closing bearing 080. I am going to make that a Bristol Bird target.
Action passes to HMS Bristol.
Captain, sir, from Glamorgan, take track 1252 with Sea Dart.
Roger, engage with Sea Dart.
Sea Dart, the latest supersonic missile. Able to hit aircraft and even missiles at long range. Semi-active radar homing. Even without a warhead, its impact is like an express train with 24 coaches.
MGD, take track 1252 with Sea Dart.
Target splashed by birds. Captain, roger.
PWO, roger.
One threat eliminated. In war, there might be 40 at once.
Controller, still neither of the Sea Kings any joy with the Nimrod search sub.
Pass to the watch, PWO.
Pass to the watch.
Patrol your sector to the eastward. There is now an aircraft threat to the northeast.
All positions AWO. Aircraft closing 050. Captain PWO AWO taking track 2004 now bearing 050 with Sea Slug.
Sea Slug, medium range missile, semi-active radar homing. The computer tells them the system stood to. This printout confirms track 2004 as the priority target. Two T's indicate the best firing bracket. The computer gives a countdown, 60 seconds to decide to engage.
AOMD, birds affirm 2004, permission to engage and ready.
The engage button. The N indicates where Sea Slug will intercept the target. Another countdown, 99 seconds in which to fire.
Stand by to fire.
F indicates the missile as it travels to the intercept point.
Captain PWO AWO Grand Slam track 2004 with birds break Alpha Foxtrot, over.
The next generation of control systems will be even more automated. The computer will make the decision to fire. A human brain won't be fast enough. But there's one big snag to missiles. Because they use part of the electromagnetic spectrum for guidance, they're vulnerable to electronic countermeasures, to what's known as electronic warfare. Electronic warfare began in the Second World War, when sheets of aluminium foil were cut into strips and dropped from RAF bombers to confuse German radars. It was codenamed Window. Nowadays it's known as Chaff. Packaged in cartridges and rockets, it's still a main countermeasure in electronic warfare. This pack contains 750,000 filaments. These are aluminium, but silver nylon and aluminized glass can be used. Each filament is a tiny dipole reflector. Its length depends upon the wavelength of the radar you wish to deceive. A wind tunnel test shows that when chaff is released, it forms a drifting cloud. When this is struck by a radar beam, it reflects radar energy back to the receiver, giving the impression of many targets where in fact there's only one. Besides chaff, an aircraft must carry other electronic countermeasures if it hopes to survive in modern war. It will need to carry a jamming pod.
Can you turn?
The pod contains equipment to analyze the frequency of an enemy radar and jam it with noise transmitted back on the same frequency. In case jamming proves insufficient, the aircraft may carry anti-radiation missiles. This one's called Martel. It has a passive radar homing head. It destroys enemy radars by homing in on their own beams. In the tail, there's an aerial to pick up enemy radar beams and give the pilot a visual warning on this dial in the cockpit. Equipped with jamming pod, anti-radiation missile, radio warning receiver, a supply of chaff, and some flares to counter infrared missiles, the aircraft can start on its mission. Countermeasures equipment cuts down the space for weapons, and it accounts for much of the soaring costs of modern aircraft, in some cases as much as one third. On a typical mission, the aircraft flies as low as possible to keep below enemy radar beams. When it's picked up by a search radar, the operator will see the aircraft as a blip on his screen. In the aircraft, the warning receiver tells the pilot he's been spotted. The dial shows the bearing of the radar. Action must be taken. On the oscilloscope, the peak indicates the frequency of the radar. The noise jammer switches on and tunes to the same frequency. On the enemy screen, a burst of noise smothers the target echo. The operator can resort to countermeasures. He can switch his radar to another frequency, and the target echo may reappear. There it is again. Frequency agility, hopping from frequency to frequency at random, is a feature of modern radars. To counter it, the pilot can resort to barrage jamming, jamming all the frequencies over a whole band. It obliterates the whole screen, but it uses a great deal of power, and the operator may have further countermeasures up his sleeve. By now, an enemy weapon control radar may have picked up the aircraft. The warning's dramatic. A missile may be on his tail. He must act fast. He can try deception jamming. As the radar beam follows the aircraft, the jamming pod retransmits it on the same frequency but with a fraction's delay. This gives the radar a false range, as though a ghost aircraft appears behind the real one. The missile will aim for the ghost. If the missile has an infrared heat seeker, the pilot can launch flares, which again decoy the missile. In one sense, electronic warfare is already going on, even in peacetime. It takes the form of gathering electronic intelligence, known as ELINT. Wherever there's a NATO fleet, there's usually a Russian trawler hovering around. But there's not much fishing going on, not much fishing gear to be seen, just a lot of sophisticated aerials. Their job is to learn as much as possible about every piece of electromagnetic equipment on the ships they're shadowing. Their search and weapon control radars, their radio transmitters for command and control. This is the sort of interception equipment used for ELINT. The screen is divided into four radar frequency bands. At the bottom, compass bearings are shown. When it's switched on, directional aerials pick up any radar beams within range and display them on the screen as pinpoints of light. The position indicates their bearing and their frequency band. You can move the strobe onto any signals you wish to analyze in detail. The readout gives you the frequency band, the signal strength, the interval between signal pulses, and the bearing. These details are the radar's fingerprint. They tell you what type of radar it is. This one in band 1, with its intermittent pulses, is a search radar. You can record a fingerprint and compare it with a library of previous ones to see whether it's an entirely new type or merely a new location of a known type. Either way, it can add to information about an enemy's electronic capability, his electronic order of battle. If war breaks out, it'll be vital to know that capability. That's why so much ingenuity is displayed in gathering ELINT on land, sea, and in the air. For many years, the Americans employed U-2 aircraft to fly over Eastern Europe. In 1960, a U-2 was sent via a base in Pakistan to overfly Russia. Over the Urals, it was shot down, and the pilot, Gary Powers, was captured. The Soviet Prime Minister, Mr. Khrushchev, called off a summit conference in anger. He staged an exhibition where the U-2's equipment was on show, including intercept equipment for ELINT. Another ferret plane used by the Americans was the RB-47. They'd usually fly along the frontiers of the Soviet bloc, but on occasion they'd venture across to provoke the switching on of radar systems otherwise kept silent. In 1960, an RB-47 was shot down over the Arctic by a Soviet fighter. Four of its crew were killed. Two were jailed as spies, but released later. In fact, over the years, there's been a steady stream of returned prisoners, some of them wounded, handed over at checkpoints along the Iron Curtain. The wounded were the lucky ones. In 14 years, 108 American aircrew were killed. In the Far East, American ELINT missions were carried out intensively. At this exhibition in Peking, there are no less than four shot down U-2s. Even war is sometimes risked. The Pueblo, an American ferret ship, was captured in 1968 as she sailed close to the coast of North Korea. Some of her crew were killed. Documents on board proved she was carrying out ELINT. The crew were kept in strict captivity for a year until the United States issued a formal apology, and they were released at Panmunjom. Soviet ELINT missions get less brutal but equally effective handling. Britain's electronic deployment is probed regularly, not just by Soviet trawlers, but by ferret aircraft such as this Bear. To limit their activities by intercepting them is a task performed day in, day out by RAF fighters. Russia's latest aircraft, the Foxbat, is now performing ELINT missions. Space satellites have superseded many missions by aircraft. Military satellites are highly secret. This one's for scientific observation, but launched into orbit 100 miles above the Earth, it gives some idea of what military satellites can do. can take pictures like this one of Southwest Britain. At the same time, they can record electronic signals. When military satellites are overhead, it's wise to switch military radars off. The 1973 war in Sinai proved how vital electronic intelligence can be. The Israelis were ignorant of the SAM-6's radars. The search radar, the lower one, is of the ordinary pulsed kind. But the target illuminating radar uses continuous wave energy. Against it, the Israelis had no jamming equipment. It was not the only surprise of the war. Former Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Pentagon, John Morse.
The Middle East hostilities in October of 1973, for example, brought great surprises. It surprised tankers, tankmen. It surprised airmen. As a matter of fact, to me it was surprising that the Egyptians, with the kind of equipment and training that they had, would undertake to make a canal crossing in broad daylight in the face of the sixth most powerful air force, the Israeli Air Force, and they did it deliberately, and they succeeded. And this foretends, in my view, some very significant changes in the role of aircraft, the role of tanks, the type of aircraft, the type of tanks that we build in the next 15 years. I think there's one overriding trend in technology, and that is the trend to put more and more destructive capability at the disposal of smaller and smaller units. Today, to my mind, the most important priority is to develop a new concept for the defense of NATO, which is more in accord with nature and the technological movements of the day than the one we now have. And without that concept, any progress we make will be desultory and not coordinated and not coherent.
In John Morse's view, to fight a successful war in Europe, NATO will have to change the shape of its armies. Traditional divisions will be broken up into perhaps 500 small units. They'd be highly mobile, many of them in soft-skin vehicles, cheaper and more expendable than tanks. They'd be armed with anti-tank missiles, with laser designators, and with anti-air missiles. The traditional front line would disappear. The battle area would be widely dispersed and swiftly changing. Concealment and hit-and-run tactics would take over, rather like a guerrilla war. The vulnerability of tanks would be magnified. Missiles would pick them off before their own guns were within range. Missiles are effective at 3,000 meters. Tank guns, around 2,000. John Morse believes that tanks would be expensive coffins. They cost £500,000, a missile as little as £5,000. Manned aircraft would find survival difficult over a battlefield dominated by precision missiles such as Britain's Rapier. Small groups of infantry can hit back with deadly effect for the first time in war. The relative costs are even more striking. £5,000 for a missile against £5 million for an aircraft.
There are some individuals who say, as I do, that drastic change is inevitable. There are others who say it's just merely a minor improvement here and there in the accustomed wisdom and accepted way of doing things. But more and more, we are finding people outside the military putting pressure on the military to take advantage of some of these new opportunities.
One reason why military planners are not rushing to discard their tanks and aircraft and go over wholesale to guided missiles is what happened later in the 1973 war. After the first shocks in Sinai, the Israelis changed their tactics. They remembered the value of different arms giving each other mutual support. They brought in infantry to hunt down the Egyptian missile crews with mortars. They used artillery to prepare the way for a more cautious advance by their tanks. And when the tanks went forward once again, they confronted Egyptian tanks in punishing battles on a scale not seen since the Russian front in the Second World War. And the Israeli Air Force came back into battle with effect. Hastily equipped by the Americans with new aircraft and suitable countermeasures equipment, they got on top of Egypt's air defense. They got the latest American missiles, such as the TV-guided Maverick, which proved deadly against radar sites as well as tanks. By October the 15th, the Israelis were back on the canal. Once across, they and surrounded Egypt's Third Army. The great powers intervened to enforce a truce, and so the three-week war ended, leaving both sides to count their losses. Between them, Arabs and Israelis lost 3,000 tanks, 6 tanks an hour. They lost 600 aircraft. By the end of the first week, both sides could only keep going with massive help from America and Russia. That's one lesson all the experts agree about. If the bullseye war were to break out in Europe, losses would be just as great. 22,000 tanks face each other in Europe. The pace of destruction would be even hotter. Some experts believe conventional non-nuclear war could only continue for a week. There'd be no time to replace losses on such a scale. So the war would have to be fought with what men and weapons were available at the start. In this sense, too, the next war in Europe, the Bullseye War, is being decided now. Thank you.